Hello and welcome to Behind the Screams. As always, my name is Ian, and in today's show, we are joined by the other two-thirds of the Cackle crew. We have Lucy.
Hey, ghoul, hey.
Hello. I'm not stealing your things because apparently I get accused of stealing your things, so you're just getting a flat hello today. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you very much. And we're also joined by Lindsay. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not going to lie. I wasn't particularly excited to watch this movie.
Yeah.
I'm excited to talk about it, but I wasn't particularly excited to watch it. But I think we're going to have a very interesting discussion tonight, to be honest with you. I think there's a lot of good talking points in this film, so it will be very, very interesting to see. But yeah, this is episode number 141. The number feels so big now. And we are talking about, in today's show, the 2019 Netflix original Velvet Buzzsaw. This was Lindsay's choice of movie. So Lindsay, why did you choose Velvet Buzzsaw?
Well, it's really different from your typical, like, supernatural horror. I think there's a lot of good commentary in it regarding the art world. I know a lot of the conversation around this film definitely specifically focuses, like, on art, but I think that can be extrapolated to so many different aspects of the art world, which I know we'll get into. And as well, I really wanted to cover it during Pride Month because one of the main characters is a bisexual man, and, well, I was going to say I think, but there just isn't really any representation that way for men at all, men who have sex with people of all genders, so I thought that would be a good talking point for us as well.
I think it will be a good talking point. It's definitely, I think it's at the top of my list, so it's probably the first thing that we're going to come on to, you know, just to piss off the non-political people, you know. But yeah, I'm excited to talk about. Before we get into the movie, we'll quickly do the housekeeping again for those of us who are listening on the download. Lucy, where can people find you on the socials?
You can find me on Twitter and Twitch at Lulu_Pew. And I also have a fundraiser going on for the month of Pride. Fundraising for Mermaids, which is one of the UK's first and biggest charities supporting gender diverse and transgender kids and their families. There's been a lot of discourse even the past week about transgender rights in the UK and lack of provisions being provided. So charities like Mermaids are absolutely pivotal. And it's the pinned tweet on my Twitter. All subs and bits for this month are getting donated. But throughout the month on my Twitch, I'm having weekly guests. We did a recording on my Twitch just last night on one of my favorite movies, which neither of you hated, which I was so happy about. Otherwise, friendships were going to get ruined. And it was, but I'm a cheerleader. So all good fun stuff for the month of June on my Twitch.
Excellent. Yeah, very, very, very good cause. So please go check out those links and please give whatever you can to that fundraiser because it is a really, really wonderful cause. Lindsay, where can people find you?
I'm at @Lindsay_ on all social media.
Okay, cool. You can find me on Twitter at IanForrest12. Twitch is at twitch.tv/Forrest_9191. As for the podcast, it's twitch.tv/BehindTheScreamsPodcast, which is funny because if you're listening to this, then you're watching this, you're already here. You can find us on Twitter @ScreamsBehind, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube is at Behind the Screams Podcast. Are you guys ready to talk about today's movie?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in today's show, we are talking about Velvet Buzzsaw.
Spoiler alert!
Critique is so limiting and emotionally draining. I'm hoping you find something to explain what's happening.
Which one's better, one or two? Better, worse, no different.
No different.
I'm quite curious to know what you think.
I think sober hasn't been good for him.
Pierce was in the full bloom of alcoholism here.
Exactly.
Never should have quit drinking.
No originality. No courage. My opinion.
I can't save you.
I found something.
Who did these? Mesmeric.
A guy upstairs, he died.
And you just took them?
He had no family or friends.
I can make you rich.
It's brilliant.
Demand has people ready to kill.
Have you ever heard of an artist named Ventral D's?
No, not in our records, and we have everyone.
The artist used blood to create the reddish blocks.
You ever notice anything about this painting? You look at it long enough, it moves.
As I research D's, I'm starting to think there's a disgust for the world of money.
I spent decades in a psychiatric hospital for the criminally insane.
There is some sort of power. Some spirit. It's connected to his art. Something truly goddamn strange is going on!
This is a slaughterhouse.
Are you aware that Dee's asked that all his art be destroyed?
Help!
Get rid of it. Box it off.
I can't save you.
People thought she was part of an exhibit.
We're trending on Instagram. It's a major hit.
This movie was released in 2019, was written and directed by Dan Gilroy, stars Jake Gyllenhaal, Rene Russo, and Zawe Ashton. The IMDb plot is as follows. A satire set in the contemporary art world scene of Los Angeles, where big money artists and mega collectors pay a high price when art collides with commerce. I actually found the IMDb plot a little bit interesting because it actually doesn't actually say anything about the horror aspect of this movie. You know, it just says this is a satirical look at the art world, which this film absolutely is. And I think that's probably the biggest aspect to it. But I just find it really interesting that the plot itself doesn't even mention that this is a horror movie.
I think that was maybe like one of the problems with this film, because it comes up a lot in like underrated horrors, and we've spoke about it ourselves. Like, I remember this coming up on Netflix, and it was just Jake Gyllenhaal's in this film. I couldn't have told you what it was about at all based on the advert. And I think that's the similar thing from the description. And if I remember from our underrated horrors episode, I found it really difficult to describe this film.
Oh yeah, I'd actually forgotten that you'd put it in your list of underrated horrors. This was the first time that I'd seen this film. I hadn't seen this film before. It was one of those ones, like you say, it popped up on Netflix. I'd seen it. I was like, Jake Gyllenhaal's in it. And I generally like the things that Jake Gyllenhaal is in. I think he's a good actor. Mm. And so I added it to my list. And you know what it is. We've all got those massive long Netflix lists that we've not gotten to most of the things that's on it. And so it ended up just becoming one of those movies. And up until a couple of days ago, I was like, oh yeah, he's some kind of like Andy Warhol type character, isn't he? Which I guess he kind of is, but that's that's not what this movie is about. Whereas it was very, very different to what I was sort of expecting. Lucy, you hadn't seen this before either, right?
No, I hadn't. I'd heard of it, but I honestly didn't know what it was about at all. And I think this is a really good example of a movie not being marketed properly. I know we've talked before a couple times about the marketing teams behind some of these films and something's being lost in the discourse, almost kind of like Daybreakers is kind of lost in the vampire genre, and there's probably other movies I can think of as well. And I would be in agreement with you, Lindsay. It's really hard to describe. Like, I can 100% say that I've never seen a movie like this before. not just in horror, just in general, taking this kind of stance on art, which isn't a bad thing. We'll get into it. I actually, there's some parts of this I do like, but it's just like when you look at it on Netflix, it doesn't really tell you what it is. And I don't really see people talking about this much online. So I didn't really know anything about it going into it. It was completely fresh.
But that's what you're saying. Like, even now, if someone was to say to me, oh, what's Velvet Buzzsaw about? I'd be like, well, do I tell them what the horror aspect of it is? Because the horror aspect of it is really not the big point of this movie. Do I tell them about the satirical commentary it's making? But then am I mis-selling the movie? You know, it's really sort of difficult. And, you know, I feel like there's a lot of times where this movie is trying also to be comedic as well, because some of the performances and some of the characters are so over the top, which I guess again is probably another commentary on the art world. Listen, I'm not a big artist person in terms of like the fine art world. I believe that, you know, there's loads of different forms of art. I believe that, you know, what we do is on the podcast is our art, you know. But in terms of this sort of thing, where it's, you know, galleries and selling paintings and this sort of thing, I'm not very knowledgeable about this sort of stuff at all. So you know, this for me could have been a very realistic representation of what the Los Angeles art scene is like. So that's the thing, like, I never know how to describe this movie. I still don't know how to describe this movie, and if I was to try and describe it, I think I would just misrepresent it completely. So let's go into our sort of first talking point. And you obviously brought it up, and we might as well start with it because we've kind of already started the conversation about it. This is a film that we obviously was quite good to do during Pride Month. I'm sure that's one of the reasons why you chose it, Lindsay, for this episode. Because we have is he bisexual? Are we told that at any point? Or are we just?
I don't think it's ever said. Maybe that's incorrect of me making an assumption, but it goes from being in a relationship with a man to being in a relationship with a woman.
Yeah, obviously there are other sexual identities that could allow him to do that, but for the sake of this episode, we would probably go with that he is a bisexual.
Dan Gilroy did say in interviews after this that Morph is bisexual. Even though it's not explicitly said, he does say he is bisexual.
I did read somewhere that he wanted him to be a very fluid, like sexually fluid character as well, because he feels like that he felt that that was something that wasn't really represented. And that goes to what you were saying earlier there, Lindsay, as well, like when, especially in the media, in film and TV, when the subject of bisexuality is broached, it's almost always with regards to women and their bisexuality, which of course is absolutely valid and is absolutely something that should be celebrated and should be shown out there. But there is actually very, very little representation of bisexual men out there. And to be honest with you, off the top of my head, I don't know if I can really name you much off the top of my head.
No, I'm the same. Like, it's something I've kind of thought for a long, long time, and I think there has been a bit more discourse about it online very recently, probably because it is Pride Month, but like, women are allowed that room a bit more to experiment in their sexuality, because it's always thought they'll eventually go back to men. But when it's men doing it, it's like, oh, it's just, they're just gay, really. And it's this whole thing that actually all sexuality seems to revolve around men, which isn't the case at all. Like, whatever way you look at it in terms of bisexuality, it always comes back to them ultimately wanting to be with a man, which isn't the case at all.
I completely agree with you. I just find it, you know, very upset. I find it very upsetting that, you know, people are so quick to just try and erase bisexuality, you know. And it goes back to what we had that sort of conversation a little bit last night as well, didn't we, on your episode about, you know, having very binary views of gender, of sexuality, you know, and how it's not like that, you know. That's just not what the world is anymore. And, you know, people people are very fluid in their sexualities and people are allowed to change their sexualities and, you know, and things like that. So I think it's
I was just thinking there, what examples can I actually think of bisexual men being represented in the media? The only two that I can think of, not even just recently, just in general, is Sex Education and Euphoria, both TV shows, nothing really in horror. However, the representation of bisexual men in both of those TV shows, they're actually kind of villainized. Like the men they're not great characters. They're two villains of the show. And again, it has this discourse of they're assuming they have to pick a side and that they're actually gay and they're not bi. And you're thinking now, we have so many discussions right now, kind of as you said, Lindsay, there is a bit more space for women to explore their bisexuality, and people don't always jump to the conclusion that, you know, a woman has to be a lesbian, but it doesn't seem to be the same standard for men. So I do really like that in this movie, that it's not necessarily questioned so much, whereas that Morph has to be gay, and you know, it's just the way he is, you know, he's very fluid.
So easy to make him a big flamboyant queenie gay.
Yeah.
And they didn't, which I think is amazing. But what you were saying is there, Lucy, as well, about like villainizing bisexual people. It's just like, how many times have you been told like bisexual people are just greedy, like they're like sex fiends, like they're not loyal, they will absolutely cheat on you. None of these things are true, and can also be said of gay and heterosexual people and mm-hmm. anybody else on the spectrum too. But just because you like all the genders, you're some kind of nymphomaniac, like right off the bat, and it's just not true at all.
Yeah, that's it. And it goes back to this whole thing is about that everything needs to be about sex, you know. And like, look, don't get me wrong, I love sex as much as the next person, and I would probably be having it most of my time if I was allowed to or able to or any of those sorts of things. However, that's not what, like, relationships aren't just about sex, and sexuality isn't just about sex, you know. And yeah. I feel like there's still a huge chunk of society that is very much focused on, if you are not straight, somehow you're some sort of sex pest, somehow you're some sort of sex fiend, you know. I still feel like there's a very huge stigma, even, and not just around bisexuality, but just around sort of gay and lesbian people as well. I still feel like there's this whole sort of thing that we're all just addicted to sex, and that's obviously not the case, for as much as I'd like it to be. I thought, Lindsay, because you brought up a good point there as well, I really did think at the beginning that they were going to go with, he's this sort of flamboyant, you know, queen type character. And then obviously he gets into this relationship with Josefina, which is obviously ultimately what really tells us, sorry, I hit my mic there, what tells us about his sort of sexuality and like that. And between Ed and Josefina, he's pretty much picked like two, like the most perfect looking people of either gender, hasn't he? Like, Morph is living his best life, just being like, he's got his pick of the men and the women, doesn't he?
Absolutely. But then there's this whole thing as well, that everybody treats Morph like he's a god in the art world, which I found, well, not bizarre, because it does happen. Like, if you think of like film critics, like Roger Ebert or something like that, like people will be like, oh, like this us. Person
like us like treat us like gods.
If one person says something about, you know, a film, a fashion, a TV show, a single or an album, people without even viewing it, experiencing it for themselves, will be like, that shit.
Exactly. And at the end, I think it's quite interesting you say that, because people do take some critic's word as gospel and will not view something for themselves and give their own opinion, because they only believe in, they're loyal to one critic or however many critics. But at the end of the day, art in any form is subjective. And I think we'll get into that later on in this movie as well. But I think it's quite interesting how some of the horror that's related to this kind of relates to when they make fun of certain pieces of of art and turn their nose down at it. And it's kind of like, well, you know, I know we'll get into that, but
does this mean that I'm gonna get killed by some terrible CGI birds?
Yes. Yes.
Ah, fuck. No, but you're absolutely right. I've completely just forgotten what I was about to say there. That's really good, isn't it? Yeah, like some critic, and that's one of the reasons, this is what I'm saying, that's one of the reasons, we want to like get as many different voices on the show. I mean, like if you look through just throughout the history of this show, the number of different people that we've had on the show at various points, you know, we've only been, this is still a young show for, let's say, we've only still been around for what, a year and a half, just over a year and a half. The Cult is a Lie says, I love spite watching things that critics hate. We pretty much everything that we do on this show, the critics seem to hate.
In a nutshell,
we like to get, and that's why we do things like the listener opinion segment, and that's why we put out the polls, that's why we do still tell you what the critics rated, because I believe and I'm sure you guys agree with me that it is so important to get opinions from all different spectrums, whether that's, you know, Joe Blogs in the street, whether that's Mr. Critic who's writing for, you know, national newspapers or magazines or whatever. Everyone's opinion is on a piece of art, whether that's a film, a painting, a TV show, everyone's opinion is just as valid as the next.
I think like with critics and stuff like that, and somebody like Morph, who obviously has a great knowledge of art, I think people maybe need to remember that sometimes they're just putting things into context. Like, they have this love of this art form and can watch something and compare it to something 50 years ago, or be like, actually it would be better going in this direction because I've studied film for X, Y, and Z, and the story, a story arc like A, B, and C works a bit better, or something like that. I think sometimes where it falls down is where it's like personal opinion. We've seen so many pieces about horror films being shit. Who do they send to review them? People who don't like horror films. It's not a fair.
I remember like, seeing judgment. Something on social media, and someone was writing a review of, I can't remember what the film was, a horror film, and literally the first sentence of their review was, I don't like horror movies. That was literally the first sentence. And this was for like a national publication. And their first sentence in it was, I don't care for horror movies. It's like, why are you fucking writing this review then?
I know,
obviously, Lindsay, like you haven't historically been the sort of biggest, not fan of horror. I'm not saying you're not a fan of horror, but you haven't, you know, like you've quite recently come into the genre in terms of being a bit more religious and watching it. Mm. I'm sure even you as well, like, because I know you study quite a lot of film and things like that. And Lucy, you'll be the same as well. We can watch a film and we can see, oh, that's taken inspiration from X, Y, and Z that happened in the 50s and the 30s and the 20s and things like that, or even just from the 80s. You know, we can watch a film now and be like, oh yeah, that's a reference to blah 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 blah. How many times do you see something and you think that's a Shining reference, or that's a Night of the Living Dead reference, or that's going back to Frankenstein, or things like that? You know, you see it all the time. And I think it is important that we do have critics to put some of these things into context for us as well, because I certainly don't notice them all, and I'm sure you guys don't notice them all as well. So I'm sure, I love hearing about a piece of trivia or something about a movie or a film, or hearing about another possible direction that film could have gone in. I still think there's huge value in having critics, but what I think a lot of people, like you're saying, it becomes this sort of fandom, doesn't it? Where people go, this critic has said this, therefore that word is gospel and nothing else can be right. So if they pan this movie, and you see it all the time, not necessarily with film reviews, but just with the whole world, where you have these people, I'm thinking like for example, the Kardashians, who could tweet out, you know, this jacket is so hot, or this jacket's in this season, and that's it. That jacket will sell like hundreds of millions of versions, you know, like you have these people that just have the ability to make or break something with one tweet.
Yeah, it's like it's a special kind of power that they have, and they know they have it as well. And you see Morph in this film, whether he's doing it on purpose or not, but he's making and breaking people's careers. And the amount of money that's been splashed out in all these art pieces, like at one point, they're talking about 8 figures for an art collection. That's hundreds of millions. Is it?
That's tens of millions.
Lots of money.
And, you know, that's a lot of money that can make or break people. You make or break someone's career.
They did that at the very beginning of this film as well, where they're just talking about individual pieces and they're like, I'm not going to sell anything for less than 5 million. This went for 3.7 million. Like, they're talking huge amounts of money. And then later in the film, they talk about it as well, where Josefina is accusing, is accusing Josefina of making him write a bad article about someone, and that person then went and got drunk and got themselves into a car crash, and almost like blaming Morph for the bad review. And so it goes back to what you're saying there as well. You know, they're literally making and breaking people's careers and lives. Sorry, Lucy, I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to say kind of a little thing we touched on there. I think it'd be interesting to discuss a bit is like the influencer culture, because when you think about it, as much as people like to bash on influencers, they are critics in themselves. And, you know, how many sponsorship deals have we seen that are probably in the definitely are. Some of them are in the millions for sponsorships of brands, because at the end of the day, some people's Instagram stories are getting viewed more than the BBC could ever hope for on prime time in the UK on a Saturday night.
Well, let's face it. If you are someone like who manufactures, I don't know, gaming merchandise, or you work for some sort of gaming company, how much are you willing to pay to get Ninja to wear something on one of his streams? How much are you willing, you know, if you're something to do with YouTube, how much are you willing to pay PewDiePie, you know? Like ridiculous sums of money, I would imagine. I would imagine their sponsorship deals would make your brain explode.
And there, with that as well, is cancel culture, because we're talking about Morph there, you know, killing off people's careers. How many influencers have we seen that do it to each other? I mean, I'm even thinking just now, I don't know if you'll be aware of it, Ian. I know, Lindsay, you keep up with some of the channels like I do, but the whole scandals that are going on with James Charles and the whole Trisha Paytas, all the key beauty guru influencers and things like that, they really can break decade-long careers on that platform with just one Snapchat rant. And like, it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition. Like, the art world would probably, well, some of the critics in this film, in Velvet Buzzsaw, would probably turn their nose at some of these Instagram influencers, but in reality, they have kind of just as much power as they do, and they're in the money game as well. It's just in a different context.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on there. And, you know, it's a very, very cutthroat world, whether that's the movie review world, the art world, the influencer world, and influencers can come in so many different forms as well. Like, listen, we are a very, very small time podcast, right? As Lindsay said yesterday, we're semi-successful, but we're maybe not quite on, I know they got canceled and things like that, but we're maybe not quite on the Nightmare on Film Street level, you know, but who knows, maybe one day, just without all the nastiness.
Yeah, all the microaggressions.
maybe without all of that. But yet, you know, like, I would still consider us as people who have, albeit a very small amount, of that power, where we have people who, if we, the three of us, was to go onto social media and say, you should definitely watch this movie, this new film that's not out yet, we managed to somehow, and which is possible, like, we do get people who are willing to offer us, you know, screeners for their movies before they're released so that they can get reviews and things like that. We've had that before. You know, so if we was to tweet out, this movie's going to be fantastic, you're going to love this movie, you know, I'm not talking about millions of people here. I'm talking maybe like, I don't know, 20 people who would go and watch a movie based on our recommendation. But that's what we're talking about, just on a much grander scale.
It's word of mouth marketing when it comes down to it, which is still very powerful. People don't realize, like, it's still very powerful.
Well, you're talking word of mouth marketing. Look at Host.
Yeah, that's a great example of it. Organic marketing, didn't have a big budget behind it to do any paid for advertising, and look how big a success that was.
I mean, it was, let's face it, it was pretty much the biggest movie of 2020, wasn't it? The biggest horror movie of 2020. And you know, I just remember that on social media, and it would just be trending, and it would just go on, and it went on and on for months. You know, like, look at something like Spiral, right? Which I know you two haven't seen yet. I have seen it, so I'm not going to spoil anything for it. But that is from, for regardless of what you think of the Saw sequels, that's probably from one of the biggest franchises in horror history. The Saw franchise is one of the most money-spinning franchises in horror history. That film's came out. Are you hearing much about it anymore on social media?
I was just thinking, as soon as you mentioned it, I was like, that's completely died a death. But then it's that way, it's like, the new Conjuring films come out, and then it's in A Quiet Place too. And it's just like, I bet in 2 weeks, we'll hear nothing about them as well.
But that's what I'm saying. But Host, that just seemed to go on and on and on. And, you know, that movie came out, I think, was it end of July? And we were still talking about it being like everywhere on social media by Christmas, which is almost unheard of, really, when you think about
it.
Okay, so let's talk about some of these characters, because we've got a very interesting bunch of characters. I'm not going to try and pronounce any of their surnames, so we're going to get them all. We're going to get them all just first name. Cult is a lie. Just on the note, says I'm still getting Spiral ads on my PS4. go and see it if you want. I'm not saying anything. You guys know my feelings on Spiral. I think I let you guys know pretty strongly. Let's talk about this character. So we'll talk about Morph first. I know we've kind of touched on him in terms of, you know, his sexuality and the influence that he has, but obviously Morph's played by Jake Gyllenhaal. So just first and foremost, are you a fan? Did you think Jake Gyllenhaal did a good job? Was there anything that didn't quite sit right with you, or anything you thought was particularly good about his character, aside from what we've already talked about?
I'm trying to think. I think he plays this just really egotistical art critic really well, who kind of believes that just some of the stuff that comes out of his mouth. I've kind of heard that from like the film side of things. Like, I just remember at uni studying film, and there was certain people that really thought that they were God's gift, essentially, and everything that came out of their mouth was just like an innovation. But then, you know, he does kind of go through a little bit of a character journey where, you know, with Ricky and things like that, and feeling the guilt of what he said. But like, I think he plays the role of this like very snooty art critic quite well. Like, I think the writing for him is done pretty well. Just some of the stuff that comes out of his mouth, I was rolling my eyes, but that's what you're supposed to do with him, you know? So
he absolutely loves the smell of his own farts, doesn't he?
Oh yeah.
Lindsay, what do you think?
Yeah, like, I really like him in this film. And I didn't realize until before watching it for this podcast as well, that this was Dan Gilroy's follow-up to Nightcrawler, which Jake Gyllenhaal was also in, and they're two like very different films, so they've obviously got like a really good connection, because this is something really different for Jake Gyllenhaal as well. He's normally in more like serious things or like actiony things, so this was really different for him, and I think he played it really well. I love the character arc that Morph goes in as well, because kind of by the end of it you realize that he's been manipulated by Renee Russo's character, whose name is totally escaping
me. Redora.
Redora, that's it. He's kind of manipulated by her. Like, there's kind of hints to it throughout the film. Like, oh, can I get the same deal that you give Redora? And he's like, what are you talking about? And he genuinely thinks he's been led to believe that he is this, like, god of the art world. And he's just a puppet on Redora's strings the whole time. And yeah, I think his realization by the end of the film, yeah, like, I really like his character arc.
Yeah, that's, I would agree. I don't particularly like Morph. I'm probably going to say that for every character in this movie. I don't particularly like anyone in this film, but I don't think we're meant to like anyone in this film. Maybe with the possible exception of Coco. She's pretty innocent in all of this, isn't she? But Yeah, it's Jake Gyllenhaal, I think, does a fantastic job at this character. I think it's probably, in my opinion, one of the strongest points of the movie is actually Jake Gyllenhaal's performance, because he is playing it kind of out there, isn't he? And like you said, he's more traditionally known for his more serious roles, you know, or more action style roles. So this is something, obviously we have seen him doing a few other things here and there as well, but this is something that was just a little bit different for him. And like you say,
one of my favorite things about the whole film is just like how camp the whole thing is. Like, and reading like some other people's reviews, like when it came out, some people were like, oh, this is so OTT, I don't like it. Whereas other people, I think, well, in my mind, got it and got that it was meant to be super campy. And I loved it.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? I did sometimes find myself being like, is that satirical? Or is, and not just specifically with Morph, just about multiple aspects of this movie.
Yeah.
Is that satirical or is that bad? Like, because there was quite a few points like that. We've also got, and one thing, you know, we're going to go obviously talk about some of the other characters. What a cast this movie has. What a cast. You know, I gave the top three there, but you can also add, you've got Toni Collette and John Malkovich in there as well. Toni Collette, who we absolutely stan Toni Collette on this podcast.
Toni Collette is not given enough credit, I think, by horror Twitter for how much of a horror icon she actually is.
She,
I was thinking 100%. About that last night. Like, she's in so many and she's absolutely phenomenal in every single one of them.
Not just horror, I think she's just phenomenal. And she is another person who always understands the assignment.
Oh yeah.
Like, she knocks it out the park so often. I remember when I was growing up, one of my mum's favourite films was Muriel's Wedding.
Mm.
And like, she's like incredible in that. And like you said, Lindsay, more recently as well, obviously she's probably well known most recently for Hereditary. But she's been in a huge number of films in and out of horror. So, you know, I think she always deserves credit. And, you know, she doesn't get a huge amount of screen time here. You know, she's not a massive part of this movie, but what she does is very important in terms of the context of showing us that cutthroat world of art. Because she obviously is playing this person who was working for a gallery, and then suddenly she becomes this advisor for a mystery client, and she's got all this money behind her, and you see that change in her character almost instantly, don't you? It's almost like, fuck you bitches, now I'm going to be one of the bitches.
Yeah.
And she just flips the switch, and she's so good at playing just this.
I think with not even just in this movie, I mean, I know she plays main protagonist as well, I stand Toni Collette all the way as well, by the way, but I think whenever she's in this, like, you can't take your eyes off of her. She really steals the scenes.
Yeah.
Just like, not even just in her dialogue, just the way she enters into the room and her body language, the way she's dressed, the aesthetic, like, I don't really pay attention to anyone else in the scene other than Gretchen, who she plays.
I think that she emotes so well with her face as well, that she really always just, she's always chewing the set. She's always such a scene stealer. Like, she's a star, and she's proven that she's a star time and time again. And I will still say she should have won the Oscar for Hereditary.
I don't even think she was nominated. It's an absolute sin.
She wasn't.
Ridiculous.
None of those, like, because there's three, isn't there? There's Toni Collette in Hereditary, there's Lupita Nyong'o in Us, and there's Florence Pugh in Midsommar. And they're like the three where people are like, they were robbed. Elizabeth Moss as well, sorry, in Invisible Man. I think Anya Taylor-Joy as well in The Witch was another one that people are like, she's up there, and they're just forgotten about because it's horror, you know, so it's typical. Moving on, I've mentioned him. We've also got John Malkovich in this movie playing Piers. I think this is just a massive waste of John Malkovich.
Yeah, there's this like whole story arc in the film that I think they could have ramped up a bit more. Where we have the two artist characters, John Malkovich and Damrish, like, who are the people who are making the art, the only people who are there doing it for the love of the form, And then we have all these people around them who are just in it for the money and are just in it for like what they can get. And they kind of try and do something with Dan Reish where he obviously leaves the gallery to go back to the collective because that's where he was happier and making his best work. But I feel like they could have done something with John Malkovich's character. Like, obviously he used to be an alcoholic and he's trying to find his new inspiration, like post-alcoholism. I feel like there's a bit of tension between him and Redora because he's not making artwork, but she represents him. And then we have the whole like epilogue of the film, which is him making swirls in the sand because that's him doing something just for himself and it makes him really happy. And I feel like we could have punched that a little bit more, the dichotomy between the artist and the people making the money from the art. And it's that is one thing that fell down a little bit for me in this film.
I just think as well, you know, you obviously we're talking about this is a very sort of underlying story. This is never a story that is particularly highlighted, other than maybe that scene where Don Don goes to goes to Piers's studio, which has possibly my favorite bit of the movie where he thinks a pile of trash is art. But he's like, because he obviously, Don Don then becomes his new representative.
Yeah.
He's managed to poach him from Redora, but he obviously doesn't realize that he has no art to actually give him. He's just got this one piece of art. And aside from that, he's obviously never, ever the focus of the movie. You know, you only ever see Pierce in fleeting moments and things like that. And I just think when you've got someone, because we know what John Malkovich is capable of. He's a very, very fine actor. And I know he's not the youngest man alive. I know he's getting on up there in age, but I just feel like you could have really had him doing something. I just don't understand why you would cast someone like John Malkovich in this role. This role could have just gone to anyone, really.
Yeah. It's like, even taking it back to the storyline, like, there is that scene where Dan Reish and Piers see the Dees artwork for the first time. And they are like so overwhelmed, like with how amazing it is. Like Pierce has a drink and he's an alcoholic, yeah. And Dan Reish actually leaves the room because he's like so overwhelmed. And then nothing else is done with that.
I feel like, oh, sorry.
No, I'm done.
No, I was just gonna say in the storyline, something else that I feel like this movie maybe goes into the same fault as maybe Daybreaker has had, where it tries to say a few too many things. Like, I feel like there could have been a really good narrative there around addiction in the art world, because the two tie together hand in hand very well. It's the same as music, same as a variety of art forms. And I really like that scene when they're both overcome by Diaz's artwork. And then, like you say, he just starts drinking again, and that's all. It's never really touched upon again. And considering, like, I can't remember how long he's been sober for, but it's been a considerable amount of time. Like, you feel like there would have been that transition, or if they were going to make it that dramatic, we could. I mean, this is a long movie anyway, so it's not as if like we couldn't have had another couple scenes of him just like descending back into his addiction and what that means for his art. And you know, we see a lot of people where the greatest art they ever made was when they were in the darkest depths of their addiction and feeling that pressure to go back to it again, because that dark state of mind is where they created their greatest work. I feel like that is like a really good plot point that they could have expanded upon more, you know?
Well, it's a plot point as well, maybe not quite necessarily with addiction, but it's a plot point that is true to life as well. Like, even people like Van Gogh or Van Gogh or however you want to say it, you know, it's commonly said that his best artwork was done while he was in the throes of depression, you know, and that's well understood. So, you know, it's a very common thing for artists to supposedly produce their best work, you know, whilst they're in their darkest places. So I do think there's an opportunity there to really have said something, like you were saying, about that sort of want to do things for the passion of it compared to the sort of cutthroat world that is, you know, art critiques and galleries and things like that. But I think it's just a huge opportunity missed, to be honest with you. And you know, it just constantly gets forgotten about. And I've seen those scenes, and then when he popped up again on my screen, you know, half an hour later, I was like, oh, John Malkovich is in this movie. Kind of just forgot about him, you know. We've got a host of other characters in this movie as well. We've already mentioned you've got Coco. There's Josefina, who we've not touched upon yet. How do you think about how Zoe Ashton performed in this movie? Because she's going up against like a really big performance from Jake Gyllenhaal, because the majority of her scenes are either with Rene Russo or Jake Gyllenhaal, which I would imagine was maybe quite interesting to be acting up against those two. So how do you think she did here?
I think she did a really good job. At the start, I actually really felt for her. You know, we get those first scenes where she's running about frantic at this exhibition in Miami. She's been cheated on. She's a crying mess. And then, you know, you have the neighbor whose is passing away in the apartment, and her life is just in absolute chaos. And then we just have this transition of her, you know, going into the dark side of art and being sneaky and deceitful and just turning into a bit of a wee cow. I start to despise her by the end. I'm like, oh, you're such an arse.
But they are obviously making a comment. This is, I took it as this is what the Deese artwork did to her.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't just me that was picking up on that. Okay, Lindsay, how'd you think?
Yeah, I think she did a really good job. Like, my only point of reference for Zoe Ashton before this was Fresh Meat, which, if anyone doesn't know, is this sitcom, UK sitcom, in which, like, 8 students live together in this, like, rundown house, and they get up to all sort of hijinks. And Zoe Ashton's character is, like, particularly eccentric. So the first time I seen her in this, I was like very curious as to what I was going to expect, like what to expect. But she's amazing in this. And I think the way, like at the start, she kind of mentions how she wants to really ferociously climb the ladder in the art world. And I think you see that money, power and success is really corrupting to her throughout the film. I think she does an amazing job.
It's one of those things, isn't it? It's like whenever you see Nicholas Holt in something, you're like, you shouldn't be in something serious, you're from Skins. Yeah. Like, you know, are you getting...
the wee guy for About a Boy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. it's almost a bit like that, isn't it? No, I agree with you. I think she does a great job here, and I do think she portrays that sort of almost descent into really underhanded tactics, you know, being really cutthroat and backstabbing, mm-hmm. and then how that filters into her personal life as well, because obviously we get throughout this movie that she's having some sort of relationship with Morph. And I know they say we were never a thing at some point, but they've obviously got some sort of connection, you know, they're in some form of relationship, and they can call it whatever they want. And then obviously she decides to go and sleep with Damrish as well, and then we get that whole scene. So, you know, it does, I think, quite effectively show how that filters into someone's personal life as well, you know, when we get these sorts of things. So that's, like I say, we've got a couple of other characters as well, but I don't really feel like there's much to really say about some of them. Is there anything else in terms of like the characters or the actors that you want to mention before we move on to something else?
I just want to say my favourite character is the Sphinx cat. If
Stella.
I had to choose one.
Stella.
See that bit when she's chasing her outside? It's like, that's exactly what chasing a cat is like. Sometimes Blossom escapes out my front door and my neighbour always has her door open and I'm trying to get her in my flat and not my neighbour's flat. And she's just like, what? What's going on? She just, as soon as you almost catch her, she just runs.
Struggle is real.
Oh yeah, we all know that pain. Okay, let's talk about one of the things I really want to talk about. So this is a movie about art, and you know, and that is the central theme of this movie. It's about the art world and things like that. We see a shockingly little amount of actual art in this movie. We see flashes of Deese paintings and the Deese artwork. We never really get like a proper look at a good chunk of the work, though, we do. We, like, I know we get a couple of the images that we see repeatedly, you know, but for the large part, they're sort of just there in the background, aren't they? Or, you know, they're off screen and we see people looking at them and things like that. And then in terms of actual artwork, we get the sphere, which I'm sure we'll come on to when we're talking about deaths. We get that piece of artwork that Pierce did have in his studio. I feel like there was a real opportunity here. And one of the things that we'll talk about later is how there's a lot of people who think the cinematography for this movie was really, really good. And I really feel like there was a missed opportunity here to have some really, really great imagery on our screen. Now, I'm not talking about showing as Mona Lisa or anything, you know, like that. But I just feel like when you're talking about a movie that's about art and about the cutthroat world of art, you maybe want to kind of wow the audience a little bit with your cinematography. And I don't really feel like, I don't think it was bad by any stretch. I think the cinematography was fine, but it didn't blow me away. And that's one of the sort of big critiques I have for this movie, is that I wasn't really blown away by what I saw. And then, you know, when you talk about how thematically this movie is centered around art, you'd think maybe that's something they would try to do. I don't know. How do you guys feel about that?
I mean, it's about art, but it's about the corrupting influence of power and power dynamics in art forms, and how ultimately art just being about the money really taints the whole thing. And I think it does try and get to the point of it being about doing art for the love of the form and not just for cash. Because at the end of the day, like, we all have to make money, but the way in which all of these art gallery people interact with each other, backstab each other, manipulate their buyers, it's not really about the art, is it? It's about money. And you can see that in other art forms. You can see it in film, when how hard is it for a director to get a passion project up off the ground, because studios have no faith in it, so they just want to turn out sequels or reboots because they're like, oh, we know this thing and it's safe and it'll make money, and we need to make money because that's the most important thing. And similarly, like in music, there's this whole thing on TikTok about industry plants, because they don't trust this like new thing that is independent just to gain popularity and make money. They'll put their influence on something for it to make money instead. And in a lot of ways, like this film, it's not about the art, it's about the money and the power and the people behind it rather than the thing itself. Like Redora says at one point, like, we're peddling perception. They're not actually peddling, like, what they sell isn't really a tangible thing. Even though you can't actually hold a painting, but what they're actually buying is something you can't, like, really touch.
They're selling an idea.
Yeah.
And a reputation.
Yeah.
It's not what the art is. It's what status comes along with it, saying, I own a Diaz piece, therefore I am, you know, very exclusive. I'm the 1%, you know, I got this exclusive piece of art. Half of it is, well, not even just half of it, the majority of it is about the representation the art presents, not what the art is itself. So no, you're 100% right there. I think that's a really good point.
So that's what I got from it. And I think it's like really important to talk about as well, because there are so many up-and-coming people, like so many people who listen to this and be like, I want to write movies, I want to direct movies, and probably feel really like discouraged by what's going on in like the creative industries right now. So I think it's really important to talk about the power imbalances in the media world and the effect that they have on what we actually consume as well. Like, what are we missing out on because some fat cat suit decided that we wouldn't like it?
No, that's very true. We kind of live in an age now where it's, I'd say it's easier than ever to get viral, but it's also harder than ever because the market's so saturated and exactly. It's so hard to get into. And like you say, once you, joys of motorbikes in the city center, but like you say, there's these, which often the critics are white men, you know, they're not really representative and often they're not specialists within the field. Like you say, they might be an art critic, but they don't, I don't know, they might not specialize in one specific style of art. Or it's like me, I'm just thinking of music critics. Like a lot of music critics hate metal, but they don't realize the technicalities behind metal music, like progressive metal and the inspirations progressive metal music has from orchestra and classical music. Like they don't get that context, so they just don't like it. So you're right, like it's just this absolute bashing of it. And for people wanting to start in the creative world can be really daunting.
I think a good point there as well is you can link that, you know, that talk about metal music and how it could be like underappreciated, you can link that to horror movies, because horror is a genre that is so looked down upon, let's be real, from everyone who's, if you are not a horror fan and you are a critic, horror movie is just what's going to be like the butt of your joke, or horror movie is just going to be seen to this thing as less than. But horror, I feel like no other genre has this ability to say things. It has this ability to make social commentaries, to be a platform for people. How many big stars now got their start in horror movies? Johnny Depp, Jennifer Aniston, they got their starts in horror movies. There's tons of others, Jamie Lee Curtis, you know, and I could go on and on and on and on, because people don't realize, you know, you have to work with effects in horror movies. Like you have to work with no other genre. You have to work with score like no other genre, because it has to be so complementary to every single little thing that's going on screen. So, you know, it's that thing as well, isn't it? Where, you know, you get people who go, oh, metal music, that's just screaming, right? You know, that's just people screaming. And horror movies just like, oh, that's just blood and guts. Like, it's so easy. You'd be like, right, okay, well, you go fucking make a horror movie then.
Just on the note of the visual side of things, I can see where you're coming from, me, and I can see where you're coming from as well, Lindsay. I don't really mind the visuals of this. I think in terms of the cinematography, it's done pretty well. I wish there was more kind of long shots on some of the paintings, especially that scene where Piers is, you know, led to drinking, and then, apologies, I've forgotten the other character's name, but he walks out because he's so overcome with emotion.
Damrish.
I wish like we could add a long shot of that. One thing, like, I wish they maybe pushed the mark on a little bit more was the special effects, because I feel like one of the last deaths that we get, we might as well jump into it now with Josefina. I really, really like that. But then some of the other effects, when we get to the supernatural elements, I feel like it kind of fell a bit flat, at least for me anyway. And when it's such a visual movie, I feel like they could have like really pushed the mark on that.
This is what I mean when I'm talking about, you know, I'm not talking about specifically just the artwork. I just feel like overall, I think the cinematography of this film, like I say, is fine. I don't think there's anything I can really pick up and think that was really bad. It just bored me a little bit. And I thought that really wasn't doing the message they were trying to convey any justice, because there was nothing on my screen that was making me go, wow, I've not seen that before. Wow, that's really amazing. You know, it was fine. It just was quite bland, I thought. Let's move on then, shall we, and talk about some of the deaths, since this is a horror movie and we've not really talked about any horror aspect yet. We've only been going for almost an hour and a half, and we'll finally talk about some of the horror stuff. So we've got a few death scenes here. I would probably say for me, the most memorable one is Gretchen's death, who, you know, she sticks her arm in the sphere, gets her arm torn off by something, and then bleeds to death. I think the cherry on the cake for that one, and that's one of the ones where I think the effects weren't amazing, but I think the cherry on the cake for that one was a little story plot line that they added in about how people thought she was part of the exhibit the next day, and she was actually laid there for some time, and the kids were making like footprints in her blood. and things like that. And I thought that's such, and it goes back to that joke I was saying earlier about Don Don thinking that the trash was art. You know, I think like a lot of people, when they claim to be artists or they claim to go to art galleries and think that, a lot of people just don't know what the fuck they're looking at.
I used to knock about with somebody who went to Edinburgh School of Art, and they used to tell me stories like that. Like, they always used to do like an end of year show, and obviously they'd have a party, and they tidied up all their beer cans and stuff and put them like in a corner, and somebody was looking at them like they were art. And there was another story that they told me about the photography exhibit. Bear in mind, this is Edinburgh School of Arts. It's full of like posh people. And one person like literally went and took like photos on Safari, like really, really beautiful pictures. And somebody else put up four blank photographs, like just like black. And it wasn't about what was there, it's about what could have been. And that person won. So it's like these kind of wanky stereotypes that we have in the world. Like, it's not that far away. So when John Don Don was like looking at the pile of trash, and Pierce was like, that is not art. It's really funny because it's like, I know people who have done that.
Yeah.
Don Don's such a dick. Don Don, no, you know, you sit there and you think that Morph is this sort of stereotypical art wanker, don't you? But it's really Don Don, isn't it? So yeah, anyway, that was my most, I think that was probably my favorite death scene in the movie, even though the effects on Toni Collette's arm being ripped off wasn't great, was it?
Yeah, no, it was very obvious that was CGI, when, you know, that could have been an awesome practical effect, but...
Exactly. We've got some other death scenes, though, as well, but what's your guys' top death scene, shall we say? We've got a few of them.
I love Josefina's. Like, just, yeah. I know it's probably, like, the least realistic one, at least the one least based in reality, but I just loved that whole visual of like the art taking over, because and like poisoning her, and then her being like trapped in the graffiti wall, because it's all her fault all this happens, really. So I think she deserved the most epic death.
I think stylistically it's the best one, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Lucy?
I'd mentioned it earlier, Josefina's is my favourite as well. I think from an effects point of view, even though it's not the most exciting, I think that's when the effects are done their best. And I think it's quite funny in the sense that, you know, Josefina makes fun of graffiti art, and then she's morphs into the graffiti, and like you said, being poisoned as well, that kind of double entendre meaning being poisoned by the art that she so desperately wanted and the fame and success, I think is really interesting. So again, that's my favorite death, but the sphere is still good. In terms of the awesome context. Yeah, I like that.
The sphere is a really good concept. They just, and I don't think they executed it particularly well with the visuals, but I do like the story that sort of comes along with it afterwards, like I was saying. We also got Morph, our main character, who dies. Was that a surprise to anyone? That was a surprise to me. I didn't think Morph was going to die. I mean, Lindsay, I know you'd seen it before, but first time you've seen it, did that shock you?
A bit, yeah, because I guess you're kind of expecting him to survive and, like, you know, break the whole story, because that's what he's, you know, he's like, oh, I'm writing this piece of D's, and he kind of starts putting all the pieces together, and he's the one that is like, we need to get rid of it all. Artwork is haunted. But I loved how he was murdered by Hobo Man after he slated it. Like, because I feel like, as much as I don't like him, but I don't like dislike him either, but I love that he kind of got a bit of his comeuppance, because he was really, like, he thinks he's an art god, and he was playing god with people's, like, art careers. So I love that he kind of got a bit of a comeuppance and got killed by Hobo Man.
Did you like Hobo Man as art?
I thought it was good. Like, it was meant to be like a commentary on superheroes and stuff. And, you know, I like a Marvel film as much as the next person, but I think the whole superhero trend is maybe getting a bit out of control. So, yeah, no, I liked it.
No place for Hobo Man in the next Avengers film. Is that what we're saying?
No. Although I think they're all going into space now, so I don't think there's a place for Hobo Man anyway.
Oh dear. Oh. Lucy, what did you think about Morph dying and how he died?
Yeah, I didn't expect him to die. I thought he would last till the end. I do like that he was killed by some of the very art that he criticized. I just wish his death was a bit more exciting, considering he is the main protagonist. Mm. I don't know. I feel like they could have maybe done something in, like, you know, the sound exhibition and stuff, when he's hearing the voices of himself critiquing art. I feel like they could have maybe done something cool there, or I don't know. It just felt a little bit lackluster. But again, I think this movie, it's the same point I have for a lot of this movie, is the concepts are really, really good. It's just the execution isn't always on par.
Yeah, I think so. I think for me, it was just over really quickly as well. Like, Hobo Man showed up, there was a really short chase, and then his death happened off screen.
Mm.
And that goes back to what I was saying earlier about some of the cinematography as well. It's just like, there's no gratification for me in this movie. You know, I'm definitely going to be killed by Velvet Buzzsaw, aren't I? We're going to slip on a DVD copy as Velvet Buzzsaw or something like that. But there's no there's no gratification in this movie. You don't get that really nice death scene. You don't get that really nice visual at times. And so I'm just always left wanting a little bit more. I actually think that the idea of this piece of robotic art coming to life and killing you, that's a really cool concept. Like, such a cool concept. And you know, in the beginning, when, you know, you see Hobo Man at, like, the end of the corridor, that is a really cool visual. And then suddenly he's like slamming the crutches up against the storage room doors, and it's really intimidating. And then he's giving chase, and Hobo Man's actually moving really quickly. And it's like, that's scary. That was really well done. And then they fucked it up by not just giving us the death scene. It's like, oh, just left me wanting. It left me wanting more, which I guess is kind of where people be like, well, isn't that a good thing? But not in this context for me.
It's particularly annoying with Morph as well, because throughout the film, like, we see him having hallucinations and stuff. So it would have been good to just get that little bit, like, extra from his death. But yeah, like, when Hoverman's, like, slamming the crutches either side of him, like, that's... it's terrifying. Like, I felt it.
Couple more just before we can move on. So we've got Don Don, who died. He was first to go. What? No, was he second to go?
No, Bryson. The guy driving. Bryson? That's his name. Mm-hmm.
He was first to go. He gets pulled. Does he get pulled? Like, I can't even tell you what happens. He crashes his car because he's trying to steal some of the art, right?
Mm.
He crashes his car, and then he gets pulled in by one of the monkey paintings.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I was trying to remember, because he gets set ablaze first a little bit.
I just,
and then that goes away.
I was just left a little bit confused by this one. I was like, well, I don't know what's going on. I don't know. What do you guys think about it?
Yeah, just a bit confusion, to be honest. And again, just a little bit, I feel like the word of the day for me is lackluster. I feel bad. I really don't want to shit on this movie, because
scathing.
I like
the concept of this movie, and I really want to like it. I just feel like I just need to give it a bit more, you know?
I have to say, I kind of agree with Lucy on this death as well. Like, I was just a little bit like, what? I didn't know what was happening. We hadn't really had any supernatural elements to this movie up until this point as well. Like, we obviously had hints at it, you know, with, I think it was Josefina, when she was playing with the art and the fireplace starts to, like, light itself.
Yeah.
We had small hints at it.
You see some of the faces and stuff move as
yeah,
well.
But aside from that, like, and you're never really, we were never really sure what it's all about. And then suddenly, obviously, this happens. And I was just like, holy shit, like, what's going on? So there was that. Then we've got the Don Don death, which is, you know, he ends up being hanged. And I actually quite like this one. This is probably one of the other ones that I do like in this movie, because I think it's a cool visual. And I like the fact not that I like seeing people being hanged, but I like the fact that we get the visual, you know, when Coco discovers him the next day, we get the visual of the sort of aftermath of it all, which we don't get with Morph. I know we get it with Gretchen, but we don't get it with Morph. We don't get it with Dora. So, you know, I did actually quite like that death as well. And there's actual good horror elements in that death as well, you know, because, you know, the room around him is changing and, you know, there's flickering lights and things. And I know this is all really basic stuff as well, but it's actual horror elements, which is ultimately, you know, what we're here to talk about as well. So I did like that death scene. What do you think of Don Don's?
I did quite like it. I actually was thinking before we were recording, I wasn't that keen on that death. But now reviewing the other deaths, I'm like, oh, actually, it was kind of good, to be honest.
For once, we've talked ourselves into something.
Yeah.
Lindsay, what did you think of those two deaths? I didn't give you a chance to speak about Bryson's death as well.
I kind of get what you're saying with Bryson's death, but then I've just been trying to, like, rationalize it in my head. And I'm just like, I do feel like the point is you're not meant to know what's going on. So I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, because it is the first death. And it's like, oh, what's going on with the paintings? Do you know what I mean? So I don't know if that's like a good enough thing to be like, oh, it's a bad death. I can't really think how you'd make it more clear.
I think the problem...
Is it that it's not a good setup for what is going to come?
I think it's the latter. I don't think it's a particularly good setup for what is to come, because everything else that happens is so different as well. Yeah. Don Don's is relatively similar with aspects of it. But, you know, Gretchen's is so different. You know, and then you've got Redora at the end, who is just completely different from everyone else again. I feel like at this point in the movie, once you get your first death, even though I get what you're saying in terms of, you know, we don't necessarily need to know everything that's going on at this point, we're still going to have some sort of mystery. I feel like you're possibly starting to piece things together. And at this point, like, I know the artwork's alive, but that's about it. That's how I felt about that. What about Don Don's?
I really like Don Don's death, because in a couple of them, and I think in Bryson's one as well, you kind of see DC's face in the back of the truck.
Yeah.
And they do this for Don Don's as well. And it's a thing they kind of abandon a bit later on for the other deaths, because it's DC's hand that pulls the noose to kill Don Don. And I think that is like a creative technique to show the supernatural aspect of it that I wish they'd maybe kept in. For some of the others, because it keeps that connection with Deese. Like, Deese, of course, never wanted this artwork to see the light of day. They've gone against his wishes and they've done it. So therefore, these people are getting punished for going against the wishes of a dead man. And I think if they'd maybe kept a bit more of Deese, a ghostly version of Deese throughout all the deaths, I think that would have tied it together a bit more. And like you say, like, there maybe wouldn't have been that confusion, because we would have seen a hand, a face, you know, a man walking past or something for every single one, and it would have connected them all together a bit more.
I think you're right. I think it just needed that little bit more consistency, didn't it, from death to death. It needed that sort of linking factor in between them all. And I know that their plan is to have the artwork be that consistent factor, but it's not, because it's not all Deese's works that actually kill the people. The sphere is.
Redora gets killed by a tattoo.
Redora gets killed by a tattoo. The sphere is not one of Deese's artwork.
Minkus or something.
So, and I think that's where a little bit of the confusion came for me as well, because, you know, even when I watched the film, I was like, oh, so Deese's artwork was killing people, you know, really trying to boil it down. And I was like, well, hold on a second. No, it wasn't. Because Hobo Man's not one of Deese's either.
Mm-mm.
So, in actual fact, it's only Bryson and Don Don that gets killed by Deese's artwork, because neither does Josephina. She gets killed by some graffiti. So the actual fact, none of the real main cast get killed by any of Deese's work. And that's where I think, so maybe on the other hand, maybe that's a good thing then, that they didn't have that spiritual connection because they're not Deese's work. So that would maybe explain why Deese didn't appear in any of them. I think maybe that's what they went for. I don't think it should take me 8 hours and an hour and a half of a podcast reviewing the movie to maybe figure that out, though. We've only got Redora as well. That's the last death to talk about, really. I don't remember. I remember seeing her tattoo once in the movie. I don't ever remember her talking about the tattoo. Did I just miss this?
How you go, Lindsay?
She was in a punk band called Velvet Buzzsaw, and they all got the tattoo.
I remember the scene now. What did you think of this? Because at this point, I'm like, I was just like, I don't know what's going on.
As a concept, I think it's a really cool idea to be killed by your tattoo. Like, I was just thinking, like, looking at my arm.
You'd
like,
be fucked, Lissy. You'd be so
getting
fucked.
Killed by the broken sword of Lord of the Rings would be cool. But, I think this is my biggest qualm with this film, is that I don't feel there's a big plot hole in that I don't feel a connection. Like you were saying there, of the deaths and everything like that. And also Redora as a character, like, considering she has that Velvet Buzzsaw tattoo and, like, the title of the film is Velvet Buzzsaw, I kept waiting to get, like, a big backstory of Redora and maybe, like, the shift happening of Morph being the main protagonist to Redora. And I don't know, I kind of almost got Perfection vibes where I was like, oh, we're going to get a meaning behind this tattoo and there's going to be, like... I don't know, I just felt like they could have given her a bit more backstory and I felt like it was building up to something that we didn't quite get. I mean, does that make sense? I don't know, I felt like there could have been a bit more context there.
I think that makes sense. You know, at the end of the day, this film is called Velvet Buzzsaw. The only reference to Velvet Buzzsaw in the film are centered around the character of Redora. And don't get me wrong, she's obviously... our second main character. Maybe aside from Josephina, it's between there, you know, between one of them is probably our second main character of this film. But you're right, aside from that brief scene where she talks about being in a punk band, her tattoo is never referenced again. And so, you know, you're sort of left thinking that it's going to have some sort of deeper meaning at some point in the movie, or some sort of plot point is going to be, and I know obviously Redora dying is a plot point, but there's going to be some sort of plot point more central in the movie that's going to really affect the story. And it doesn't. It's just forgotten about until that very last scene where, I know it bleeds at one point, right? Or is that at the end, just before she
dies?
That's
at the end.
Is that at the end? I thought it was maybe going to be a second scene. See, I'm getting confused. You know, it's just forgotten about until that final scene, and so it just feels a little bit like, well, why is that even there? Like, she could have just had her hating some other artwork. And then again, it's like we've talked about, it's having that connection between all the other deaths, because again, it's not a Deets work. Not only is, you know, everyone dying by different sort of methods of art. And I do like the fact that they include a tattoo as an art form, because I feel like that's something that's very often overlooked from artists, is that tattooists are artists. And so I did like that commentary around that as well. But yeah, like I'm with Lucy again. Like I feel like there's a big piece of this puzzle that's missing. I feel like this is a 100-piece puzzle and we've only got 99 of the pieces. Look at me only doing 100-piece puzzles. Does that, I'm with you, Lucy, though. So I'm trying to make points about this movie, but then at the end of my point, I'm like, I don't even know if that made any sense whatsoever. And I think that's just the thing about this movie. Like, it baffles me. Did either of you guys find this movie really difficult to take notes on?
I don't take notes, so.
Oh, check you being like, I do all this from memory.
I do.
I could never.
I take extensive notes. I found this such a difficult movie to take note. Number one, because it's very fast paced. You know, especially in that sort of like opening 45 minutes, because the scenes are very short and there's a lot of dialogue in this those scenes as well. It's very, very dialogue heavy, this movie. We're constantly getting pieces of exposition in this film. It made my wrist sore. It's one of the few times where I actually watched it not on my PC, and so it made my wrists a bit sore taking notes for this one.
I think that's the thing about Fedora's character, though. Like, when you're saying there's a lot of like exposition and backstory, like there is this whole thing about her selling out her like punk lifestyle to become this, you know, millionaire art dealer, and then ultimately it's these like punk roots that give her her comeuppance for selling out in the first place and doing this really like immoral thing, because we've not actually spoke about the thing that kind of kicks off all the supernatural things, and it's Josefina and Redora, you know, deciding that they're going to sell all this artwork that never should have been sold in the first place. So I quite liked her death, that it was like her punk 80s punk roots that are murdering her for selling out in the first place.
I definitely see that connection there as well. But again, I just feel like should we really be having to have like a full-on conversation before for some people to understand. Like, I get, obviously, you don't want to spell everything out for everyone. I think this movie expects a little too much from its audience, I think, overall, in terms of putting everything together. Let's talk about that plot point that you mentioned, though, because we haven't talked about it. Obviously, the big crux of this movie is that Josefina finds this art in a dead man's house. We do get the plot point right at the beginning as well, that his instructions were that this artwork was to be burned. And in fact, he was in the process of burning his art. I also feel like there's a whole backstory there that we don't get as well. And I know we do sort of get glimpses into Deese's history. They talk about how, you know, he was in, that was it the 2 years he spent in the army, that he tortured and murdered his father. You know, so we get, you know, little bits and pieces of that backstory there as well. Josefina, I don't know if Josefina initially had plans to sell all this artwork, but obviously she knows the money that she could make off of it. And then Redora, that's just talking about host. Redora gets, she spies it, isn't it? She like bursts into Josefina's flat, the fucking gall, pretty much forces her to cut her in, doesn't she? But then they concoct this whole story, because like in the art world, you need to prove like a lineage of ownership, don't you? You need to prove, like, it needs to be certified, it needs to be all of these various things, and they pretty much bullshit it all, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. There's this whole thing with the lawyers where they like make up a story, and again, that is something that we see a fair bit in the media as well. Like, like with the first thing that came into my mind was with the Mary Poppins series, and the author fucking hated that film. Like, as much as it's a classic, the author absolutely hated it. She always said she never wanted any of her other books to be made into films. And then a couple of years ago, her estate like gave Disney permission to make a sequel. And I just feel like that's really disrespectful. There's things like as well, Justin Timberlake wanted to do some concert with a hologram of Prince. Prince hated Justin Timberlake, and Justin Timberlake took any and all opportunity to take a swipe at him as well, because he's an absolute garbage person. And B, Prince never wanted to become a hologram either. He's like, when I die, that's it. Like, don't resurrect me for a concert. And we see it in adverts, that really famous advert with Audrey Hepburn for Galaxy. It's like, she can't give permission to be in that advert, but somebody's making money off of that. Mm-hmm. But it's, as much as it's like their estate, it's not them, they're dead, they can't give permission. And there's something about that that just doesn't sit right with me.
There's something a little perverse about it, isn't there?
Very. there's this whole thing as well, like technology's come along so far that you could make any singer sing whatever you wanted just by tapping a few keys on a keyboard.
It's the whole deepfake thing, isn't it? Like that's gonna cause some real world problems very shortly. Like
that, I'm
not on board with this at all, because they can make it look like any celebrity is saying or doing things that they don't want to do. And I know there's a big concern about deepfake porn and things like that as well, but that's what it is. Lucy, you were about to say something there.
No, I was just gonna say, I think that's a really interesting concept that you're speaking about, Lindsay, that I was wanting to touch on as well, is like, how much have we seen in, like, not even the past couple years, actually quite a long time, of people romanticizing artists and celebrity deaths? Like, how many people have we seen where they have not even re-released their work, they've released like never before seen music? We see it a lot with music artists. They haven't given any permission for that to be released. They don't have a voice. Like, it's really disrespectful to the artist. So
didn't we get that with Prince as well? Wasn't there a whole thing about Prince has this whole album worth of music that had never been released? I'm sure I remember seeing something about that with Prince. And look, don't get me wrong, if you're a fan of someone, they die, of course you want new music of theirs. Like, I would love for Freddie Mercury to release a new Queen album or something like that. But you just have to make peace with the fact that that's it. Like, and yeah, I'm kind of with you guys on this. I'm not always particularly comfortable. Listen, I've nothing against sort of celebrating the music of a certain artist or the art or whatever of a certain artist after they die. And I think, you know, but I just don't do and release stuff that person can no longer put their name to, really. You know, like, you know, people who are used, like, it's like when, you know, politicians, especially in America, use the music of musicians, shocking that one, they use musicians' music to, like, come out to at rallies and things like that. And how many times over the past, like, 4 years did you hear people, especially with Donald Trump, being like, I didn't give you permission to use my music. Like, I don't want to be associated with you in any way, shape or form. Mm-hmm. You know, so you see it all the time, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I kind of love this supernatural plot point, because all these people who profit off of this man's work, when he explicitly said, I want this destroyed, it's not even I didn't want it released, I didn't want it sold for money, I wanted it destroyed, they all end up being corrupted by this supernatural force and dying. And I just love that, because you shouldn't be above that sort of thing. You shouldn't just be like, oh fuck it, they're dead, who cares? It's just like, no, like, all you have in this life is your word, and you should respect that.
What I do like is, as well, it's this plot point really does collide two worlds, doesn't it? It collides the fact, is he destroying his artwork because he just doesn't want people to see his artwork? Is he destroying his artwork because he knows there's a supernatural element to his artwork that he doesn't want to get out there? Regardless of the fact, both of them makes the same point of, this man's dying wishes was that his artwork was to be destroyed. And then you could argue, there is it the actions of the people who then go and you know, disobey those rules that cause the artwork to have a supernatural element, or did they have a supernatural element to begin with?
I suppose that throws up the question of the ending. Do you think it's going to carry on? Or do you think, because they're only selling it for $5 at the side of a road, that
it's over?
These people will be fine.
I read it as it's going to carry on, but I can equally see how it could go either way there.
Because they don't know.
No. Lucy?
I don't think it's going to carry on. I could see how it would, but I feel like, you know, all these people that were selling these art were already incredibly successful, you know, upper class, they didn't need to make this money, but they were doing it out of sheer greed and wanting the notoriety. And I think that's like a key point of this film. Whereas, you know, if you're selling it on the side of the road, I don't know. I don't think if it was him coming back from the grave, tormenting and killing them, I don't think he would mind somebody doing it on the side of the road. Maybe just these shady artists who go against everything that they believe in, you know, for a quick buck at the end of the day.
Yeah, like I say, I think it could easily go either way, this one, to be honest with you. And I do like the fact that it is left on that sort of open note of this is either continued or it's not. I like the fact as well, though, when that the lady at the end does buy a piece of artwork, she's buying it because she thinks it's pretty, you know. She says, oh, that's really, I can't remember the exact word she says, but she pretty much said, you know, that's really pretty, that's really beautiful, something like that. Buys it for $5. She's purchasing the artwork because she really appreciates it, whereas everyone previously was, they didn't care what the artwork was. It could have been anything. It could have been shit on a paper for all they know, but they knew they could make money off it, and that's why they were loving it, whereas this woman was buying it, you know, buying it for herself. Like I say, we've got other aspects. I mean, there's a few other aspects we could talk about here. The fact that we find out at one point that Deese was using his own blood as paint, and, you know, how that potentially links into his whole sort of backstory. But I don't really feel like that. I feel like that's something that's just sort of thrown in there. And like, why did we really need that piece of knowledge? I was like, it didn't add anything. I didn't look at the movie any different or anything like that. But that's kind of it for my list of things to talk about in this movie. I'm not going to lie. Like, I came into this episode fully prepared to pretty much shit all over this. And through our discussion, like, because before you came into the call, I went to Lucy. I was like, Lindsay better prepare for this.
Well, I was going to feel really bad for you because I'm not, I didn't want to hate this because I don't like disliking Lindsay's movies. But
it's fine for my ones, eh?
Yeah, I don't mind shitting on yours.
But no, I totally get that. Like, I still think there's huge missed opportunities in this film. Mm-hmm. I still think there's quite a lot that I would personally like to see or like to have seen changed. This isn't going to be my favorite film. I'm not certain that this is going to be a movie that I will ever revisit. But I've probably, well, we'll get to it later in the ratings, but I probably talked myself into a slightly higher rating than I was initially intending on
giving. That's good. I feel like we've been talking ourselves down the last few weeks.
It's interesting how that happens sometimes, isn't it? Like, sometimes you'll watch a movie and you'll come away from it and you'll think, yeah, that was good, that was good. And then you start to analyze and you think, actually, that wasn't good. I came away from this movie thinking that this is not a good film. And now that we've had a discussion, I maybe understand a couple of things a little bit better. I can say, right, okay, I can see why this is. I can see why this is, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things we come on here to do, isn't it? Is to have that discussion to, you know, as well as have a piss take and a laugh.
Well, I think that can be like the good side of critiquing. Like, we've all talked about it. We all obviously have very different perspectives and come into it, and we're all talking about it and maybe understanding things a little bit better. Like, some of the stuff that you guys have said, I'm like, oh, I actually never thought about it like that. And we all have a different opinion of it now, and it's not that one person's better than somebody else, or like, oh, I'm so knowledgeable about this, therefore you should think this. It's just like, we've just had a mature conversation about it. And that's what it really should be about.
It's shocking what can be achieved when you have some positive discourse, isn't it?
It's kind of like the topic of the movie. It's like, you know, it's subjective. We're all viewing this in our own ways, but we're all valid in our opinions. Mm. And, you know, respecting each other's opinions really isn't that difficult, folks. Nope. You know,
I'm only being nice to it because I just don't want this movie to kill me tonight.
it's Birdemic coming for you.
It's Birdemic coming for me. Yeah. That's fine. I'm never going to say anything nice about that film. Is there anything else, guys, about this film? Any other aspects of it that you want to talk about that we've not covered yet?
No, I think I've covered all my stuff.
Lucy?
I just want to reiterate again, because I feel like I've been well negative, but this is a real breath of fresh air. Not even just in horror, but I've not really seen an art movie like this that kind of really highlights, like, it's part satirical, but it's also highlighting the corrupt side of the art world. Like, I mean, I know we haven't seen every single movie in existence and we never will, but I really haven't seen anything like this before. So it is really unique.
I do like the color palette of it as well. You know, there's a lot of white in this movie, you know, white surfaces and things like that. It's very bright at times. It's quite in your face. I do like that aspect of it as well. So just quickly mention that. But if that is everything, we shall move on to our next segment, and we are going to talk about some trivia. But there's not a lot of it.
Nah, I don't think there would be.
You may be shocked to know. We normally start off with the finances of the trivia, but this is a Netflix original movie, so there are no finances to be talked about in this movie. There was one thing that shocked me, though, because I tried to find a budget, and the only figure I could find, and in fairness, it's Wikipedia, so like take this with a pinch of salt, because this figure shocked me somewhat, is that the budget of this film is $21.2 million. And last week we talked about Daybreakers having a $20 million budget and being like, where the fuck did they spend that money? And if that is true, where did the $21 million go for this? I know it's got a good cast, but where did the $21 million go for this?
Yeah, I have to agree. Like, I know there's some big names in this, but I don't think they would have taken that much. Or unless it was, like I say, this was Dan Gilroy's follow-up to the artwork. This is Dan Gilroy's follow-up to Nightcrawler, which obviously did really well. It was like very critically acclaimed, so maybe they just gave him a bit of a boost for this.
Yeah.
It was the Sphere. That's what it is.
The Sphere, of course. Drilling those holes. That sounds bizarre. Never mind. I'll just move on. yeah, so that's the finances. I mean, this isn't even trivia. All the principal characters are killed by the artwork that they express disdain for in the movie. It's not even trivia. That's just what happens. You know, but that's probably one of the most interesting pieces of trivia I could find. Not so much about the movie, but more about one of its characters. We talked about her earlier. This is Toni Collette's fifth horror movie in her career. Can you guys name her other four?
Hereditary.
Hereditary.
Yep. Two more. Don't know if you'll get it, to be honest.
I don't know.
There's a Christmas horror film in there.
Recent one.
Krampus,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
One more.
Give us another hint, go on.
No.
Oh, she's savage.
It's a vampire. It's a vampire movie.
Oh, that doesn't drill it down any further. Oh.
Anola says Knives Out. You could technically, I guess you could class Knives Out as well in there. Horror elements, so I would say that. Fright Night.
Oh.
It's in Fright Night is the other one as well. So yeah. Becoming a bit of a, we sort of mentioned earlier, she's becoming a bit of a sort of pillar of horror, isn't she? She's very much an icon of horror. So yeah, good for her.
Well deserved.
The only other piece of trivia I have is the Urban Dictionary definitions of Velvet Buzzsaw. Would you like me to go through the three definitions on Urban Dictionary of Velvet Buzzsaw? I feel like Lucy is maybe already aware of what these definitions are based on her response there. So yeah, number one just means vagina or vulva. There you go. Number two is burying your face in a girl's crotch, sticking out your tongue and shaking your head as vigorously as possible without causing spinal injury. That's very important. Don't hurt your spine. And number three is cunnilingus, performed by shaking the head rapidly from side to side and allowing the tip of the tongue to rapidly brush the clitoris. But in that one, it doesn't specify anything about your spine, so you can put your back out for that one.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was just cunnilingus in general. I didn't know it was a specific technique.
I think it's pretty much like sticking your tongue out and motorboating the fanny, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. As eloquent as ever.
I have a way with words, me. It's terrible, but that's it for trivia. Does anyone have any other trivia?
No.
I'm trying to have a look if there's anything that comes to mind. Apparently the movie's tone was influenced by The Exorcist, according to Roy Gilroy, which, what was he said? He wanted to construct a believable world inhabited with believable characters that are caught up in crazy events. Looked at Exorcist and thought of how powerful it is when everything starts normal and real, only for the world to be flipped around with craziness. I don't know if I necessarily got that, but I kind of get his...
I get his rationale.
Yeah.
I definitely didn't get that from this film, though.
No.
But that's fine. Okay. Well, if that is going to be it for trivia, we should move on. Probably the shortest trivia segment I think we've ever done on this show. We'll move on to our final segment, which is the ratings and the final thoughts. And as always, we shall start off with the critics. IMDb rated this movie a 5.7 out of 10. Metacritic scored it 61 out of 100, which I was a bit surprised at. Metacritic tends to be the harshest of all the critics' scores, but 61 they gave it. Time for Lindsay's favourite game. It's time for the guessing...
Lindsay likes it too.
I do like this game,
It's time for the Rotten Tomatoes guessing game. Since this is your movie, Lindsay, you can go first. What do you think the Rotten Tomatoes critics scored Velvet Buzzsaw?
I am going to guess 55%.
Okay, Lucy?
I feel like the critics... Well, I don't know. Would the critics like this because it's kind of shitting on critics? Probably not. I'm going to go 40.
Okay. Lindsay is definitely on a roll lately with the guessing game. She's pretty close. It was 61%.
Oh, that's all right.
The critics give it. I feel like... I actually felt like that this movie was critic bait, to be honest with you. The critics' consensus... if you only watch one art world satire with horror overtones this year, or most others, it should probably be Velvet Buzzsaw.
I don't think there's another film like this.
I think that's the kind of the point, isn't it? There?
I know, but when they're like, oh, like there's a whole load of films like this out there. It's like, oh, this is the one you should pick. It's just like, there's no other option.
We'll move on to the audience score. Lucy, you get to go first this time. What do you think the audience scored Velvet Buzzsaw?
I'm gonna go 65, I think, just above average, I would say.
Okay, Lindsay?
I'm gonna go 60.
I mean, these are both kind of way off.
Oh.
Lindsay is closest. So Lindsay takes the clean sweep once
again. Second week in a row.
Once again. 35%.
Oh,
that's savage.
And this is what I'm talking about. I think this was critic bait, this movie, and not necessarily fan bait, to be honest. You know how you get those movies that are clearly lip service to the fans, not necessarily to the critics? I think this one was a little bit in reverse, to be honest with you. So... like, that didn't really surprise me that it got quite a low score. Before we get into the listeners' opinions, though, we will, of course, give our scores. And Lindsay, like I say, it's your film, so you get to go first. What are you going to rate Velvet Buzzsaw on a scale of 0 to 10?
Velvet Buzzsaw isn't a perfect movie, but it's something really different. I think it's got a lot of good commentary on power and corruption and money in the creative industries. I would highly recommend any horror fan to watch this just based on how different it is. And I really enjoy it. So with that, I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
7 out of 10. Interesting. Lucy, what's your score?
I know I have really been nitpicky with this throughout the episode, but overall, I do like this movie. I think it's important that we noted right from the start that it gives representation of bisexual men, which we so sorely need, not in the just in the genre of horror, but in media in general. And like we've all said, it's a breath of fresh air. Like, there's nothing else really quite like this. Would I watch it again? Not necessarily, but would I tell somebody else to watch it at least once? Yeah, I would. I think the cinematography is great. The casting is great. Like I said, I feel like the concept of this is really good. It's just the execution is a bit off the mark. But with that, I think it's above average. So I'm going to give a 6 out of 10.
6 out of 10 for you. Okay, so it comes to me to be the Debbie Downer of the ratings, as per usual. There are certain aspects of what you've both said there that I do agree with. Lucy, I agree that it's, you know, it's given really important representation to bi men. I agree that I think there's a lot of really clever ideas. I like the overall concept of the movie. We talked about how, you know, it really does portray this sort of taking advantage of people who are no longer with us and that sort of fine line between doing things for the art and doing things for money. You know, you do have that sort of stories like, at the end of the day, we all need money, but we do things for the love of it. And, you know, that sort of fine balance. I think there's some good ideas around some of the kills. Don't think the kills are particularly executed well all the time. I think ultimately, I'm left wanting more. This movie left me unsatisfied. When I finished watching this movie, I didn't come away and think, that was a good watch. Even, you know, you can do that even with bad films. You can come away and thinking, you know what? I enjoyed myself watching that. I'm not sure I enjoyed myself watching this movie. Which again, is not necessarily, I don't think is a fault with the actors. I think all the actors did a fine job. And I think some of the cons, I think there's an issue somewhere in there with the writing, to be honest with you. And I think that really, sometimes you can sort of gloss over that. But when your film requires you to put so much together, when your film requires so much dialogue, so much exposition, a problem with the writing then suddenly becomes this massive, massive issue. I wouldn't watch this movie again. I'm not going to say that I might watch this again. I wouldn't watch this movie again. And I'm not 100% certain that I would recommend this movie to someone else. But I still don't think it's a terrible movie. I think it's bang average, which is what I thought last week about Daybreakers. So it's going to get the same rating for me. It's going to get a 5 out of 10.
No halves this week, Lindsay.
No halves. Lindsay is incredibly satisfied this week, which makes a change. So given that, given our scores combined with the critics' scores, Jesus Christ, Bear.
He's having a right good old story there, isn't he?
All our scores combined with the critics' scores gives Velvet Buzzsaw an average score of 5.5 out of 10. And that puts it in 77th place of the now 105 movies, horror movies we have covered on this show. Puts it one place above Teeth. And one place below Terrifier.
That's three films I actually quite enjoy altogether towards the bottom.
I'm just shocked there that Teeth has that score since I gave it a 0.
I know.
My 0 clearly didn't influence it enough. listen, I think it's about right, to be honest. I don't think that's about right for Terrifier. I think Terrifier should be much higher up. But I think that's about the right placing for the movie. I could just think of so many movies that I would rather watch than this.
Yeah, it's a kind of film, it's not going to be for everyone, but I just love it. I think it's something really different, and there's nothing else out there like it, so
mm-hmm.
I enjoy it.
I get that. Okay, let's move on to the listener opinions. Of course, every time we review a movie on this podcast, we throw it out on our social medias and ask for you guys who are listening to give us your opinions of the film, and then we choose, you know, 6 or 7 of them and you know, read them out on the episode. We also throw out a poll. I don't know if I fucked up the poll. It didn't get as much responses, but we still got a fair chunk of voters. So this poll, asking you to vote either yay, nay, or meh, depending on how you feel about the movie. So we got 40 responses on this week's poll. 45% voted yay, 35% voted meh, 20% voted nay. So it was actually quite a low nay. I was expecting the people who didn't like this film to be higher, even though that the yeas aren't particularly high. It is, however, the lowest scoring movie we've now done this year in terms of the polls. Previously, that was a mantle that was held by Birdemic. But this ended up with our scoring system scoring just a couple of points lower. And it has finally been the movie that knocked you off top spot. It wasn't quite Candyman as I thought it was going to be, but this one is...
I did it to myself!
You have Navdi to blame but yourself. No. It lowered your average. It lowered your average for the year. So you're now down there.
And God, I've been on top all this year. Every single week I've been at the top of the leaderboard. So it was about time.
Listen,
you'll get it back.
I will.
No, next week, shoe winner, because I've got a cracking film next week that'll score very highly. But anyways, we throw it out to our socials. So here are what some of you guys had to say about this movie. We'll start off with Eric Anderson, who says, loved it, batshit crazy, naked Jake Gyllenhaal. That's all I need.
Didn't even talk about that.
We didn't.
Oh, yeah.
Was that float in your guys' boats? Yeah, okay.
Nay for me, but I can appreciate that other folk will enjoy it.
WJ Brown, it isn't what I expected or wanted it to be, but that's nothing against it. I think that's a fantastic review of this movie, to be honest with you. I don't, because no one knows what to expect from this film. Like we talked about at the start, I think that's a great way of saying it.
Yeah, how do you describe this film? You can't really.
We've just talked about it for 2 hours and I still don't know. Jim Morton, I enjoyed it, but not enough to rewatch it. I'm kind of with you there. Connell Bain, loved it. Great satire of the art scene and criticism. Incredible cinematography and terrific performances. I said terrific, weird there. The whole concept of haunted paintings has always fascinated me, and I loved what this movie did with it. I also dug the themes of greed, deception, and self-consuming ego. Lee, like T, had no business being as good as it was. Our very own Wolfie, who is not here tonight, but says, interesting concept, intriguing characters, overall good story, and it taught me that if I see an interactable contraption at a museum, to never, ever put my hand in it. Ever.
That's a good lesson.
It's a very good lesson. The moral of the story is just don't put your hand in pieces of art. And then finally, Pilot Error Podcast, waited the entire movie for something interesting to happen or for it to make any sense. I'm still waiting.
The shade of it all.
Absolutely shady as hell. This movie really did split opinion. Like, there are people out there who think this is a great film, and there are people out there, this is a very polarizing film. And I feel like, even though we've all given slightly different scores, I feel like we all come in the sort of same range. Yeah. You know, we're in that sort of middle group, really, aren't we? I know you guys are a little bit higher on it than I am, but I feel like we're all sort of in that sort of middle group about it. I'm in the meh category, but I hadn't seen it when I put the poll out, so I didn't vote.
This is the first one I've voted on for 3 weeks.
So that's gonna do it for this week's movie review portion. If you're here live in the chat, stick around because we're gonna do the post show as always, where we do any shout outs and review, go over some of our stuff again. But next up on the show is on Thursday. Our next show is going to be on Thursday, another live show, and it's going to be our second Behind the Screams horror quiz.
I'm so excited to lose.
We're going to be pitting Lucy and Lindsay against each other once again, with yours truly as the quiz master. Lindsay, you hold the crown. Enola's ready to trivia. I'm going to have to make this a good one. So basically how it's going to go is, it's going to be on the movies that we have reviewed this year so far. So we've now done, what, 20, about 30 odd movies, 30 movies this year, be something like that. We must be closing in on that. So all of the questions are going to be based on the movies that we have covered this year, just to make it a more of an even playing field. Last time we just did it on movies we had covered on the podcast, but of course not, you guys weren't involved in every episode. So I kind of felt it was maybe a little bit unfair for you. Yes, Enola says 30 and it's only June. We just churn out the content here. We're content machines. If we do say so ourselves, we're very modest about it as well. So yeah, that's going to be on Thursday, same time as this. But next week's movie review, it's back to my choice next week. And we're going all the way back. We are going back 88 years, and we're going to be talking about the original Frankenstein. Have either of you guys seen that one yet?
I have, and I love a classic horror, so I'm excited for this.
Yes, I'm excited. I know one of the things when we, quite a while back when we did one of our live shows before we were here live, one of the things that people said they wanted was for us to do more of the sort of old classics. And we've done a couple now. We've done House on Haunted Hill. We did, what was the other one we did? I can't remember now. It's gone right out of my mind. We've done another one, right? We've done Night of the Living Dead from the 60s. Yeah. Have we done another one? We've got Psycho coming up as well later in the year. The Birds. That was the other one. We've done The Birds. And so, yeah, we'll be doing Frankenstein. I forgot the name of my own film there. We'll be doing Frankenstein next week, so I'm very much looking forward to that. Lucy, before we go, for those listening on the download, where can people find you on the socials?
Find me on Twitter and Twitch at Lulu_Pew if you want to see more of me and Peble, because honestly, it's Peble's Twitch channel as well at this point. Yeah, you can find me at Lulu_Pew. I'm also doing a fundraiser for the month of Pride, fundraising for Mermaids, which is one of the UK's first and biggest charities that support transgender and gender diverse children and their families. And like I said at the start of the episode, even in this past week, there's been a massive discourse in the UK about the lack of trans healthcare and resources. Mermaids is a great charity that I feel like doesn't get enough love, and they do so much for the trans community within the UK specifically. So I'm having a variety of guests on my Twitch for the month of June, playing a variety of queer indie games and also some classics like Life is Strange. And I had you two on last night for a review of But I'm a Cheerleader, which was so much fun. And I've got a couple.
It's a bad in my head that you said that. And I was like, what, you two were on your show? I don't know why that popped into my head.
It's just a chaotic day today. That's what it is. Yeah, chaotic brains.
It's been very manic energy today, hasn't it?
It definitely. Mm-hmm. But lots of more exciting stuff to come on the Twitch in the next month and more guests. So keep an eye, because it's all for a good cause as well.
Definitely. Lindsay, where can people find you?
I'm at @HiItsLindsay_ on all social media.
Sweet. You can find my personal social media accounts. I'm on Twitter at @IanForrest12 with two R's. You can find my Twitch channel, twitch.tv/Forrest_9191. As for the podcast, find us on Twitter at Screams Behind, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube's at Behind the Screams Podcast. And we're also on TikTok at Behind the Screams Podcast, where you can check us out there. But Lucy, Lindsay, thank you once again for joining me on this week's show. I appreciate you as always. Thank you to everyone who's listening to this on the download. Like I say, if you're listening to us live, stick around, because we'll do a short post show in just a moment. But if you're listening to us on the download, thank you so much for downloading. We really appreciate you guys as well. And we hope you guys will join us next time on Behind the Screams.